Welcome to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Here's your host, Laura Turner.
Hello and welcome to another special edition of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight has a very special knack of capturing the heart and soul of what makes our Australia great. As a writer and performer of stories, songs and plays, he's dedicated decades of his life to travelling around the country, collecting and sharing stories. He's just released his 21st book, another instalment in his Great Australian series, in which he's told tales of Australian flying doctors, our shearers and drovers, the police, railways, the CWA, our outback towns and pubs, and many more. In his latest release, Great Australian Volunteer Fiery Stories, he shares the memories of our courageous firefighters, the men and women who roll up their sleeves and selflessly put their lives on the line to assist their fellow human beings. It is my pleasure to welcome Bill Swampy Marsh to Great Australian Lives. How are you, Bill?
Good, thanks, Laura. Yourself?
Wonderful. It's so good to have you on the show. You have had such an incredible career. We just mentioned your latest book about Great Australian Fireys. You've written about so many wonderful Australians, of course, but what inspired you to hit the road and talk about our volunteer firefighters?
Well, I'm from Adelaide, and we had, way back in the early 80s, we had an Ash Wednesday. And I remember driving through the Adelaide Hills and seeing it was just stark. It was like a moonscape. And then the story started to come out of what the fireys had done, the volunteer fireys. You know, they're pretty selfless people, and that kind of twigged it. And as we were going through as I was working through the series of different stories of, you know, funerals, CWA, like you said, it was always in the back of my mind. And So about 3 years ago, I started getting contacts of people who I could have a chat to, and I was kind of lucky. I finished the travelling at the beginning of 2020, just as the fires were really getting going over on the East Coast.
You begin the book with an excerpt from The Fire at Rose's Farm by Henry Lawson, one of Australia's, of course, most celebrated bush poets. Can you set the scene for our listeners? Can you read that poem for us?
One Christmas time, when months of drought had parched the western creeks, the bushfires started in the north and travelled south for weeks. At night along the riverside, the scene was grand and strange. The hill fires looked like lighted streets of cities in the range. The cattle tracks beneath the trees were like long and dusty aisles, and on a sudden breeze the fire would sweep along for miles. Like sounds of distant musketry, it crackled through the brakes, and all the flap of silvery grass, it hissed like angry snakes. It leapt across the flowing streams and raced o'er pastures broad. It climbed the trees and lit the boughs, and through the scrub it roared. The bees fell stifled in the smoke or perished in their hives. And with the stock, the kangaroos went flying for their lives. Yes, one Christmas time, when months of drought had parched the western creeks, a bushfire started in the north and travelled south for weeks. At night along the riverside, the scene was grand and strange. The hill fires looked like lighted streets of cities in the range.
Such a beautiful piece of writing, isn't it?
Oh.
Bushfires hold a pretty distinct presence in the hearts and minds of Australians, don't they? Have they been a part of the communities you've lived in?
Yes, they have. And somebody just on the bushfire, somebody said it was one of our greatest tools, but yet our greatest master. It kind of rules us if it gets away, as we've found out, it can cause a hell of a lot of damage and heartache. But if used properly, you know,
absolutely,
it keeps us warm. It does our cooking and everything else. So it's a double-edged sword.
Absolutely. Did you find, as you mentioned, the volunteer fireys play such an integral role in our fight to save our communities when the fires do get out of control. Did you find that they were willing to tell their stories or pretty private bunch about what they go through out there, you know, on the front line?
The ones that I spoke to were pretty keen to tell their stories. So I found that quite easy. I've been doing it for a while. So, and it's also important that I feel it's important that I do spend those 2 or 3 months of the year travelling so I can actually sit down with a lot of the people, the majority of the people that have got the story. So you're actually face to face rather than just ringing up and saying, hey, have you got a story to tell? Which it puts up an instant barrier. But no, the people that I spoke to were absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, that it is so important. I think especially with people like this, it is, as you say, so important to sit down with them and have that rapport face to face. And I think people really relax, and that's what you would need, because there would be a lot of trauma involved in some of the stories that you're telling.
Oh, yes. Well, there was. And it started off when I got the idea. Like I said, I'd experienced the fires over here in Adelaide. I thought, oh, gee, this is going to be a horrific book. But as I went on, I started writing it and getting into it. I thought it was what shone out of it was that it was a celebration of the human spirit. I'll just talk about Australians being volunteers. They've got jobs as well. So they're in the middle of a job and the fire siren goes and they just drop everything and head off down to the fire station, jump on the truck and off they go to fight the fires. And some of them, a couple of the stories in the book, there were some of the fireys were fighting a fire just 20 kilometres or so from their own property, and they knew that their own property was at that exact time being burnt out. So there's a lot of selflessness in it too. People, giving to community. Community came through very strong, supporting your community, being part of your community. And the social side of the fire brigades came through. It was kind of like, like a footy club, if I can put it that way. People get together socialise, have a couple of beers, barbecues and things like that. And that drew the community together, where the fire station was kind of almost the hub of the town.
Yeah, absolutely. And we see that every summer that, all eyes are on the fire station and the wonderful volunteer firefighters who do so much for our communities right around Australia. You do in the book touch on the horrifying spectre of the arsonist. What did you learn most about, that dangerous character, the arsonist, and not just a character, they're real people out there, but while researching and recording interviews, what did you learn about that?
Well, I went into two cases. One was from a lady over here in Adelaide, up in the hills at Harrogate, and the other one was from a fella over in from Churchill, who lit a number of fires, and he's still actually in prison from it. And it was both of them were very different psyches. The general thing is, it's a white male, in their 20s who is undereducated and has got a beef about something, which in a way the fellow over in Victoria did, yet the lady in Harrogate here up in the Adelaide Hills, she was a part of the community, so it was really hard to actually nail down, who would have done it, the suspect, so to speak. But there was obviously some past trauma in their life, revenge maybe a little bit of a part of it, and also something else that was a part of it. They wanted to be heroes. So the fellow over in Churchill, he used to light a fire, and then he'd be the first on the scene, you know. And that's how they kind of twigged. He was with the brigade for a while, and they ended up kicking him out because he kind of gave himself away. And there was another person up in the Hunter who did the same. You know, they'd always be the first one to turn up in a fire when nobody else knew where the fire was. So. Devastating it was.
This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funeral, celebrating lives. Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. For more information, tobinbrothers.com.au. Our guest tonight is award-winning writer and performer of stories, songs and plays, Bill Swampy Marsh, who's just released his 21st book, Great Australian Volunteer Fiery Stories.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Rain will fall tonight. The shadows gone their separate ways. We'll be home all right.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals. Our guest tonight is Bill Swampy Marsh, author, songwriter, storyteller and performer. We just heard a little bit of Bill's song Open Roads. In his latest book, Bill pays tribute to the brave men and women around Australia who dedicate themselves to protecting life and property as volunteer firefighters. Now, Bill, before the break, we were talking about the people you sort of chronicled in that book, but there were some pretty amazing characters that you profile in there as well. Tell us about a bloke called Rusty Crowd and his fellow volunteer firefighter, Drip Torch Jack. More of old school mates and some incredible stories to tell.
He got what's called the AFSM, which is like the VC of the firefighting brigade, and he belonged to a small district, a small council area, and he was a cane farmer, and he actually started off with I think he had a 44-gallon drum of water in his ute, in the back of his ute. That's how they started off, and then they'd drive out and put in, siphon it out and put the water into knapsacks, and people would go and fight the fires there. But over a period of time, he got the brigade up and going, and he put a levy on the, he was the instigator of putting a levy on the council rates to support the local fire brigade. And he brought it up from there to there to there, and he fought a number of fires, and then very influential within the community. And he had a mate called Drip Torch Jack. Now, Drip Torch Jack was kind of like that fellow, what is his name, Kerrigan in the castle.
Dale.
Tell them they're dreaming.
Dug another hole.
Tell them they're dreaming. But he was a bit more forward than that. If anybody gave him or to tell him to F off, he'd say. And he was a real character of the area. And a drip torch is kind of like a canister with a petrol diesel mix in it, and it's got a long spout which has got a bent spout, so the fire doesn't get back up. And you light the end of the spout, and then you turn on the torch, and it drips fire. And why they do that is they drip it along, and then they to form a fire break, so they burn back towards the fire from that fire break.
Burning,
but Drip Torch Jack has got his own special drip torch. He does his own special mix, which is beyond the required legal. and he goes out in his thongs and t-shirt, and the way he goes to burn these fire brigade fire breaks going, and if anybody tells him about you know, you should be wearing your shoes, mate. You know, he does the Kerrigan thing, you know, tell him to F off. But
he's OHS for him.
Yeah. No, but he's one of the characters up there, and he's been in the brigade up there with Rusty for yonks, you know, ever since the brigade first started off. He's just one of those fellas that lives by his own rules, but yet does a great job by doing it.
Yeah, I love that. There's so many characters like that in the book, and I'm sure you would agree that's what makes the book. I'm sure you would agree that's what makes the book. It's not just about the way that we fight fires, but the people, the people who do it.
Yeah, and that's what in all my books. You know, I know that we pick a theme and we stick to the theme, but all the books are really about people. You know, the character of people and why they do things and their idiosyncrasies. And you know, I've certainly run into a lot of people with idiosyncrasies, though I can't really talk that much about that because I've got a few of my own. So,
but that's the thing, Bill. We all do, and that's
And I hope I'm sure it brings the book to life. You know, that there's an actual person there, and we write them in a way that in more of a conversational manner instead of a written manner. So, like would be in history, it's like I'm trying to capture the reader sitting down at a table and listening. Actually listening to the person tell their story rather than reading a written story. And I hope and I feel that the connection between the storyteller and the reader is closer that way.
Yeah, it certainly feels that way reading the books. Now, talking about idiosyncrasies, I want to learn about you and your childhood. You spent most of your years in rural southwestern New South Wales, and tell us about your memories from there. You had a bit of a different childhood, didn't you?
Yeah, it was. Dad was actually a bank manager, and we ended up in this place called Beckham, which only had 64 people in it. And the reason why we were there, we ended up there, was that the bank at that particular, before that particular time, thought that there was going to be a big tin strike at Beckham. And so they built this magnificent bank, double brick place. It was beautiful. The only trouble is by the time Dad got there, that they'd found the tin strike was about 30 kilometres away down at another place called Ardlethan. So we lived in this lovely, lovely house, and Dad had to drive back and forward down to Ardlethan, where he had a little bank agency down there. But it was a great upbringing. You know, you'd just leave home in the morning and wander off with your mates, you know, or well, only had to because there are only 64 people in the town. We'd wander off, and then at tea time, you know, the mothers would get out in the backyard and shout or ring a bell for us to come home, and so we'd come home. And I've always kind of said that was in some sort of way the instigation of me writing these outback stories, because but perhaps in a funny kind of way, I'm still trying to get rid of the dust that I collected when I was a kid. But I really enjoyed it.
It sounds idyllic. How did the nickname Swampy come about?
Oh, that's from the marsh. You know, a marsh is a swamp, and I think a lot of, you know, if you're born with the surname of Marsh, it's obligatory that you're called Swampy or something like that, you know, along those lines. Or another marsh I met was called Bullrush. Anything to do with boggy areas, but I've just had to.
At least you didn't get boggy.
yes, you're right there. Could have been worse.
I think I'll call you Boggy for the rest of the interview, Bill.
Yeah.
You had big dreams of being a cricketer for a while there, didn't you? Of playing professional cricket when you were young.
Yeah, yes, I did. I went to a a boarding school. Now, you know, which might sound a bit posh, but it was the only one within the area. There were only 15 of us kids in the school in Beckham, so I had to go somewhere. And I ended up at a place called Yanko, and it was an agricultural boarding school where the farmers used to send their kids. The thing was, it was a bit different than a normal boarding school, is that we had to work on the farm. So we'd be up at 6:30 in the morning and work on the farm and then go to school. And then after school, we'd go back and work on the farm. You know, that was part of our education. But they were very, very strong on sport. And I, in particular, kind of shone as a cricketer. And so that was kind of the way that I thought my life was going to go, because I wasn't very good at the academic side of anything. I never have been. So I thought that was the way I was going to go. And then I kind of fluked it into college, and then I got very sick, and so that was the end of that. And of course, it was glandular fever, and I couldn't go out in the sun for about 3 or 4 months, and I'd get blinding headaches. So that was kind of the end of my cricket career. And so I had to sort of find something else to do. And at that stage, I was about 19, I'd say. Yes, I was about 19. And of course, you know, women were a big thing when you get to that age, especially coming from a boys' boarding school. And I thought that if I could learn how to play the guitar, I'd go pretty well with the women. The only trouble was that after my first lesson, I forgot what song I was supposed to be learning, but he gave me the chord chart. You know, where you got three dots, where to put your fingers.
Yeah.
And I started playing with those, and it was astounding that within about 10 minutes I'd written words to go with a tune that came out of those two or three chords, and that kind of sort of changed my direction in life. You know, I found that I could write something. And so it started off with the music, and then as time went on, I wrote a couple of little pieces for the local newspaper. I was in a place called Griffith in the Riverina by then. My dreams kind of grew and grew and grew. And but it's been a disaster. I must say, if you don't mind me rattling on a bit. It was a disaster because I thought I was going to be a famous songwriter, and went over to England when I was 19. Well, you know, travelled for 2 years and ended up in England to sell all my songs. And I was writing about tractors and love and stuff. You know, I was kind of a cross between Slim Dusty and Donovan, if anybody remembers him. And I got a demo disc done. It was actually at Abbey Road Studios where the Beatles were. I never met them or anything like that. But I got a demo, and then I thought, okay, well, I'm going to go off and sell my songs and become famous. So I started off, I thought, well, I'm at Abbey Road Studios, which is an A, so I started off at A, and then I went to see them, and they said, oh, they're nice, but... And then I worked my way through the alphabet, you know, to Beetlejuice music, to, you know, Come All Ye Faithful music.
And well, did down you get to?
Zoot music, and they said, oh, have you ever been to Abbey Road Studios? They may be interested. That was the worst winter of my life. And they were also, that was when David Bowie was big. And here's me writing songs about tractors and love. And they were saying, oh, can you write anything like David Bowie? You know, and as I said, you know, we've been talking. I grew up in a town of 64 people, you know, and so David Bowie.
You're not putting London, a leotard on.
You know, we were kind of a bit at odds with each other. There, no, it was a disaster. Yeah. But I just loved writing. I don't know why. It was just something that was in me, and I you know, through all those disappointments. And the same with writing. When I was in the wine industry for a long time, and I gave that up to take up my writing. You know, I was writing stories and stuff by then. And I'd send off, you know, manuscripts to all the publishers and all that. And I'd get knocked back after knocked back after knocked back. You know, I once won a prize at the South Australian Writers' Centre for the most rejection slips. Everybody had brought in a little folder, and I just about needed a suck trap to bring in all my rejections. But 2 o'clock in the morning, I'd wake up and I'd have an idea of a story, and all those rejections would get forgotten, and I'd get stuck into the next story. I can't work it out really myself.
What a beautiful way to find your feet, Bill Swampy Marsh. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. Our guest tonight is Bill Swampy Marsh, writer, storyteller, songwriter, and more with him in just a moment.
And I dream that we all live together, every child, every woman and man, and we learn to love one another, and together we joined in and sang. Oh, my heart, it belongs to Australia. Oh, my heart, it belongs to the land.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight is Bill Swampy Marsh, who's just published the latest book in his Great Australian Stories series. And in that series of books, he's told great Australian trucking stories, bush funeral tales, police and teaching stories, CWA stories, and many more. In Great Australian Volunteer Fiery Stories, he pays tribute to the volunteer firefighters who put their lives on the line to save people and property in the face of horrific danger. Now, Bill Swampy Marsh, your series has been so successful and has covered such a broad range. Tell us about some of your other favourite topics. I want to hear about the funeral series.
Yes. I really love that. It might be my sense of humour, but I thought it was the one of the funniest books that I've written. And a lot of the stories were from funeral directors and priests that, you know, were conducting funerals and things like that. So I tell people, I'm writing a book of funeral stories. Have you got a story to tell, you know? And people, the initial thing was shock. Oh, no, I'm not going to, you know, do that. And then about 10 minutes later, they'd come back and said, no, I was at a funeral once and, you know, something bizarre happened at the funeral. So it was... I just absolutely loved it. You know, we had priests falling into graves, and one of the other ones was at a funeral. I don't mention the names of the people who tell me the stories, naturally enough, because they might get in a bit of strife. But there was one priest that was telling me about one funeral that they'd had. It was in a crematorium, And this son, he was an adult son with a child of about 5 or 6. He hadn't seen his mother, who died, and she was on the plinth ready to go into the fire, and he went up to the priest and said, "Look, do you mind if I just have 5 minutes alone with mum before you start the service?" So off he went, and his son went in there with him, and he broke down when he got to the coffin, and sort of slumped on the coffin and started bawling his eyes out. And the little kid, of course, got a little bit bored, and the little kid was wandering around, and he saw this button there. There was a red button and a green button, and the little kid kind of just pressed the green button, and all of a sudden the coffin started to move. And there's the bloke, he kind of woke up out of his grief, and there goes his mum, you know, and she goes behind the screen. He's running around, disappear, you know, trying to find, how can I get mum back? He's trying to pull mum's coffin back, but it's on the rollers, and off it goes, and poof, up she goes in a puff of smoke. And so he went out to the priest, and he's kind of explained what was going on, and luckily there was a funeral just about to start because there was, you know, there was a string of funerals that day. And the next coffin looked pretty much like the mum's coffin. So they swapped over coffins and they did the service. Nobody actually knew that the mum had gone. It was already up, and so kind of that's how it ended. But I just felt for this poor fellow and such grief. And here's his little kid. You know, kids are like that. If they get bored, they just go around pulling things and pushing things.
Yeah.
Saw this green button. Yep. Press the green button, and off rolls poor mum.
That is the. I've got to read that one in your series. That is the most incredible story. You've also written about your own personal challenges. You lost your dad in 1990 due to heart problems, and in 1994 you suffered a heart attack, which culminated in you writing your third book, Looking for Dad. Cathartic was it for you to write that?
It was cathartic, yes. And Dad and I got on really well when I was a kid in Beckham, and then when I went to boarding school, I kind of, you know, adolescence kicked in and all that kind of stuff. And I was kind of, there was that separation. And then, of course, I ended up in Adelaide and they were away up the north coast of New South Wales, and I'd only ever see them once a year or so. So there became a distance. And then I had my heart attack in 1994, and then I got in touch with Mum, and she went back through Dad's records, and he had his first heart attack, not the one that killed him, but his first heart attack was 2 weeks before Christmas, which mine was 2 weeks before Christmas. And we were both the same age. And all of a sudden that kind of that distance that I thought we had became frighteningly close. And so I got Mum to write down a list of all the places where Dad had lived and worked in his life. And I jumped in my car in Adelaide, you know, I mapped out all those little places, and I drove back to all those little places where he'd lived and worked, and wrote stories about the places and what were perhaps his memories of the places and the people that I met there. Along the way, and I finished up at Lismore in northern New South Wales, which is near where they worked at where Dad was in the bank there, and finished up in the cemetery there. But it was great because I was by myself travelling. You know, it was about 3,000 or 4,000 kilometres there and back. So I was in the car by myself, and I don't know how it happened, but I kind of started talking to Dad. So we were driving along, and I'd be kind of having this conversation to Dad about you know, the things that happened and the things that went wrong and the things that I had a beef about and all that kind of stuff. So even though he'd gone, it brought us together.
Oh, that's beautiful. And to have the talent you do to be able to do that for your dad is such a wonderful thing. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And in these challenging times, Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. For more information, tobinbrothers.com.au, and more with Bill Swampy Marsh in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Day after day, when you're away, you just keep them towing the line. There's no time for tears, and there's no time for fears, yet a voice, it's etched in your mind. For a drover's wife, it's no kind of life. For a woman keen on settling down.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives. Our guest tonight is Bill Swampy Marsh, writer and performer of stories, songs and plays, whose new book, Great Australian Volunteer Fiery Stories, is in stores now through ABC Books. Now, Bill, we've talked all about your books and how you found your love of writing through music, but did music is there a musical gene in your family? I mean, where it was obviously natural to you, but do you know where it came from?
I don't know. My sister was. I grew up with my two elder sisters who claimed that they were the ones that mothered me. Now my elder sister was very, very good at the piano, and she was invited to go to the Sydney Conservatory. And so from when I was a little kid, I always remember her practicing the piano in the background. So whether that came through or not, yes, it must have. Because you're a little kid, you know, you absorb stuff that you don't know that you're absorbing. But there was always piano music in the background and fur release and things like that. And when I hear that, it takes me way back to when I was, you know, 3 or 4. So it was perhaps.
Yeah, it's funny. Funny you say that. My mum's a classical pianist, and that same song, Fair Elise, strikes a chord in me that I, you know, just takes you back in time. That's but then again, I can't play a thing. So you obviously picked up on it more than I did.
osmosis, musical osmosis. But they're good memories. Like you were saying, you know, listening to that piece of music, music's magic. It can take you back to where you were, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, and just zoom straight back to that particular spot. Some of the songs you hear, there's something magic about it.
That's absolutely right. And speaking about magic, and you have told some magical Australian stories, do you have a theme you know, of people or stories that you're going to tell next in the Great Australian series?
Yes, I'm currently working on a collection of ambulance stories, AMBO's stories. Once again, that might sound horrific, and you know some of the stories are. But as we were talking before, it's the people. I'm focusing on the people and their stories and their characters. And then I did a series a while back of outback towns and pubs, and I think we're going to do another collection of outback towns and pubs a couple of years down the track.
I love outback Australia, and I'm sure there would be so many incredible stories on top of what you've already done from outback pubs. They're just, you know, they're the beating heart of all of those places, aren't they?
When I wrote the first one, I was, you know, coming from that little town I did, Beckham, with 64 people in it. I was going to call it Great Australian Stories from Little Outback Towns. But everybody I interviewed, the story that they had told either began in a pub or happened in a pub or happened from an event from a pub. So that's why we added the extra little outback towns and pubs, because most of the stories kind of surrounded the pub.
That's wonderful. Now, your book, your latest book, Great Australian Volunteer Fiery Stories, is out now, and you can find all the details of this book if you're listening tonight and interested. You can find all the details of Bill's music and books, and, of course, much more via his website, billswampymarsh.com. Bill, I want to thank you for being with us. It has been so much fun.
Yeah, good on you, Laura. That was fantastic.
Thank you. And if you've enjoyed our chat with Bill Swampy Marsh tonight and you'd like to share it with a friend, subscribe to the Great Australian Lives podcast. Of course, join me the same time next week when we celebrate another great Australian life.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.